As we wrap up 2025, one thing's clear. Uncertainty isn't temporary. It's the world we live in now. Noble Gold Investments helps Americans protect what they've built with real gold and silver, holding value when everything else feels uncertain. Visit NobleGoldInvestments.com and take your first step toward a safe future. This holiday season, when you open up a qualified account, you'll receive 10 one-ounce commemorative silver holiday coins. Visit Noble Gold today.
Past performance may not be indicative of future results. Investing in precious metals, including gold, involves risks. Consult with your tax attorney or financial professional before making an investment decision.
I used to love my morning coffee until it stopped loving me back. The bloating, the discomfort, it just wasn't worth it anymore. Then I found Everyday Dose, coffee with benefits. It's real coffee blended with mushrooms, collagen, and nootropics. Now I get my morning ritual without the crash or the discomfort. The Black Friday sale is on. Get 61% off your first coffee plus starter kit, a free A2 probiotic creamer, and over $100 in free gifts. Plus, you could win $100 cash or even get your entire order refunded. Head to everydaydose.com/podcast or use code podcast at checkout.
Hello everybody, and welcome to a new episode of Gaming in the Wild, a video games podcast about games from the artistic, creative side of the tracks, from indie to AAA. My name's John, I'm your host, I'm a journalist based out in Reykjavik, Iceland, where, this evening, it is a grey, blustery, windy day, there is a windstorm going on outside, lots of people screaming and shouting as they run past. And it's been like that all week. It's been an interesting week for me. Here in Reykjavik, I had my first solo art exhibition for quite a few years in the last week. So I've been out of the house and at the gallery for most of that time. It's been a really interesting week, really fun to show some new work and see some friends. Lots of good people came down to the show. And I was there looking after the show for most of the time and welcoming people and explaining the work and so forth. But it did mean that I had some periods where I was alone in the gallery with the work, and I used that time to play something on my mobile, on my iPhone, using a Backbone controller to control it and turn it into a little mini Switch. And the game that I played was an Apple Arcade exclusive called Fantasian, or Fantasian. It's an oddity in the Apple Arcade store in that it's a JRPG made by some of the people behind the original Final Fantasy series. And it's been an interesting one for me to play, having not played one of those types of games for quite a few years, actually. So I'm looking forward to talking about that one today. I've played the first section of the game. It's coming out in two parts, and I had a lot of fun with it. It was good to play in short bursts, but also surprisingly addictive once you actually get into it. And that's been the main game that I've played in the last week. I haven't played a lot of other stuff. I have also been dipping into Cozy Grove almost every day for periods between about 5 minutes where I just check in and can't be bothered, through to playing like half an hour and clearing all of the tasks on the Cozy Grove Island. So it's been all about the Apple Arcade for me, which I guess is what Apple Arcade is for. It's for playing on the go, it's for playing on your phone when you're not necessarily in a position to sit with your consoles and a TV and all that sort of thing. So I've been getting the most out of my Apple Arcade membership in this last week. But the big news this week, I guess, was the PlayStation presentation that showed off new gameplay for Horizon Forbidden West. And if you've been listening to the show for a while, you'll know that I'm a huge Horizon Zero Dawn fan, and I played it last year for the first time, the original. And so I've been waiting with bated breath to see what the new game looks like. And there was quite a lot of juicy stuff in that presentation. There was 20 minutes of gameplay for the start of the game. And it looks like a direct sequel in almost all ways. It looks a lot like the original Horizon Zero Dawn. Aloy looks the same in it. Still the protagonist, still the same gameplay style. It looks like it has heavily upgraded visuals. It looks kind of stunning in a 60 frames per second. I think it was PlayStation 5 footage that they showed. And it looked very smooth, very detailed, very crisp and colourful. It looked really stunning. It's set in San Francisco, so we got to see some of the Golden Gate Bridge, of course now collapsed in the far future. And we got to see some combat, which looks similar to Horizon Zero Dawn 1, with elements of stealth, elements of archery, and lots of kind of avoiding, diving away from things, and taking on giant robotic animals. Looked really fun, and that interspersed with narrative beats where you're talking to characters, getting missions, using your focus scanning device to scan the environment for places that you can interact with. But one of the only bugbears that I had with the original Horizon Zero Dawn was the climbing, because it came out the same year as Breath of the Wild, which obviously had free climbing. You can climb on basically anything you can see, from trees to kind of buildings to mountains. And it looks like Forbidden West has tried to update the climbing, because in Horizon Zero Dawn, that was a big problem with the gameplay. You would often run up against invisible walls. If you're running up a hill, there's kind of a point at which the angle becomes too steep and you just slide back down again. Although I have to say, it doesn't look like they've gone all the way with it. It still looks like there are demarcated climbable areas. So it's not what I was quite hoping for, which is complete freedom in a 3D world. But something else that they've taken from Breath of the Wild is the introduction of a glider. In Breath of the Wild, obviously, you can use your kind of parachute hang glider to climb up to the very tops of buildings and then to jump off the top and float across the landscape and take in the landscape on your way down, which is really cool, a really cool mechanic from Breath of the Wild. And Horizon Zero Dawn has incorporated that into the sequel. So they've definitely taken from games like Assassin's Creed Odyssey and Breath of the Wild and updated Horizon Zero Dawn. It now also has underwater swimming, much like Assassin's Creed Odyssey. And so it looks like they've updated the Horizon Zero Dawn game world and gameplay to include improvements to the open world formula that have come out since the first game. And I'm interested to see what they do to innovate within that. It looks like Aloy now has a hookshot, so as you're jumping, you can shoot and pull yourself onto high ledges and things like that. But I'm really curious to see what, as well as just updating Horizon Zero Dawn, if they have managed to innovate within the genre and add something new to it. I didn't see anything like that, really, in the first gameplay trailer that we've seen, but I'm hoping that they're going to, as well as improving and updating the original, bring something new to the table as well. So let's see. They didn't give a release date for it. It looks like they're aiming for Christmas period of this year, but they haven't set a release date, and so that in itself suggests that it may slide into 2022, but let's wait and see. But as I was playing through Phantasian and having a good time with it, it made me think a lot about, I used to be really into the JRPGs, and I played Final Fantasy VII when it first came out in its entirety, in its four-disc epic entirety. And playing Phantasian made me think about other games in that genre that I might enjoy now. And I did dip into Ni No Kuni on the Switch last year and played, I think, 5 or 6 hours of it, and got a little sort of sick of this kind of overworld map that flashes into turn-based combat, that flashes into narrative story sections. But having played Phantasian and become more accustomed to that format again, I think I might dip back into Ni No Kuni next and see if I can get further into the game this time. So that might be a game that you will hear about again soon in coming episodes. I'm also thinking about trying to finish off a couple big games that I got like halfway through last year, such as Red Dead Redemption 2 or Death Stranding. But I am feeling the JRPG atmosphere at the moment, so I'm going to scout around and see what's out there, see what I missed, see what if anything good is on sale. I'm kind of curious about things like Xenoblade Chronicles. I do have Fire Emblem as well, which is another turn-based kind of RPG-style game. So maybe I'll end up dipping into one of those. But Phantasian definitely gave me a taste for JRPGs. But before I do talk about that game in more detail, I will quickly mention that this show has a Patreon. It's Patreon-supported. You can go to patreon.com/gaminginthewild if you enjoy this podcast for the first time today, or if you're a regular listener. I do always love it when I get a message from a new patron and they say that they've been listening for the last year and they've just decided that now's the time to join up on the Patreon and support the show. I met someone like that the other day, so hello to Patrick, who has been listening to this show for quite a while. He lives here in Reykjavik and He had some nice feedback on the show. So if you're interested in supporting the show, you can go to patreon.com/gamingin the wild. You'll get extra episodes, you'll get sale recommendations and an invite to our Discord server, where you can talk to me and some of the listeners of the show and some nice people and friends and other podcasters, share what you're playing and see what others are too. I'll put a link in the show notes so you can click right through if you want to join up. So that's patreon.com/gamingin the wild for that. And with that out of the way, let's move on and talk about the featured game of the episode, Fantasian. So Fantasian is a 2020 game by Mistwalker, and that's a company that was started by the producer and maybe the kind of innovator of the original Final Fantasy series, and that's Hironobu Sakaguchi. And he's credited as the producer on lots of those original pixel art Final Fantasy games. He has said that Fantasian may be his last game as he approaches retirement. And he brought some of his old team together for this game. The music is by the original Final Fantasy composer, Nobuo Uematsu, who also said that it might be his last game for health reasons. And Uematsu has said that he spent 13 hours a day for an entire year composing the music for this game. And Fantasian was announced in 2019, when Apple originally launched Arcade. So it was one of the flagship games for the service, and it only just came out this year. It's available for iPhone and for iPads, and it has touch controls, or it has full controller support. I played it on my iPhone XS Max with the Backbone controller, so I had the two sticks that I could use and the buttons and shoulder buttons, and it played very well on that setup. I did try out the touch controls and found them to be serviceable. You just tap on the screen to head where you're off to, and a little red pin appears on the screen, and your character walks over to it, and the turn-based combat worked okay. But I was very happy that I was playing it on a controller. It was much better, much more intuitive. I think it would look great on an iPad, so perhaps the optimal way to play it is on a nice big iPad or a large iPhone with a controller. But you can try out the touch controls too, they weren't bad. I've just finished today the first part of the game. That's everything that's available now. It took me about 20 hours to get through in total, and it's a game that's being released in two halves, with the second half promised later this year. And the game is described by the developers as an exciting new RPG set against a spectacular backdrop made from over 150 handmade dioramas that blends physical environments and 3D characters. And I think they are right to focus on the visual aspect of the game. It is definitely the star of the show here. But my description was a love letter to classic, sweeping, turn-based JRPGs with all of the charm and eccentricity that comes with that. And this game did remind me a lot of my time playing Final Fantasy VII. The story beats are similar. I mean, it's overtly a tribute to that game in some ways, from the design of your main character, Leo, who is like a kind of a typical contemporary JRPG hero, and that he is kind of androgynous, kind of beautiful, dressed all in black, with a shock of white spiky hair. I would say that he looks like his parents could quite easily be 2B from Nier Automata, and Cloud Strife from the original Final Fantasy VII. He looks like those two have been melded together. And there are some other things that it has in common with Final Fantasy II. For example, in that Final Fantasy game, there is a material known as materia, that are kind of charged power crystals that you can use to plug into your weapons to give yourself extra abilities. And that mechanism does exist in this game. You can plug jewels into your weapons to power yourself up, but there is also a substance in this game called mechteria, which made me laugh when I first saw it, because materia and mechteria, you know, it's a very clear reference. And one of many. This is truly a love letter to old-style JRPGs. And I would say that for some players, that will make or break how much they appreciate this game. As an original Final Fantasy VII player, it definitely took me back to that era of gaming. And I felt a certain kind of nostalgic warmth around playing this game that I haven't felt for a really long time, because it hasn't been my genre since then, really. But Sagakuchi is on the record on this. He has said that he felt inspired to go back to his roots after playing the original Final Fantasy VI in the year 2018 with some of his colleagues who had worked on that game. And he decided at that point that he wanted to go back in time. He wanted to emulate the big classic JRPGs of the past. He said that it was a style that he enjoyed, and old styles can be great in their own right. So it's very mindfully so. And the game has been pretty well received since it came out. On Metacritic, it currently has a 7.9 from critics and an 8.9 from users. Although I will say that I did scan the user reviews and saw lots of phrases coming up again and again. Lots of them ended with the words highly recommended. Some of them even used bullet points to explain the dioramas and the different features of the game. And so I'm not entirely convinced that that's a fully organic user response and a user score there. But 8 from the critics can't be argued with. 7.9. It's a pretty good score. Most of the critics really enjoyed this game. It got a few 10 out of 10s. And the lowest score, I think, was a 7. So it's done pretty well. But let's talk about what this game actually is, especially for people that haven't played the original Final Fantasy VII. You play as Leo, spiky-haired, kind of boy band, J-pop, JRPG superhero. He comes to in a giant factory. He comes out of a trance. He's in a factory that is kind of crumbling and shaking, and he has a couple of robots with him who are asking what's wrong because he seems to have collapsed. And so your first task in this game is to battle your way out of this factory. And this is where you're introduced to the turn-based combat, which is like a staple of the genre. It's turn-based party combat, so you're usually controlling three combatants. And it's like the game has several phases. It has the exploration phase, where you're walking around. It has narrative phases, where you're talking to other people and hearing story. In this game, it also has flashbacks that are included in that. And then it has the combat phase. And so as you're walking around the game environment, you'll occasionally get a screen flash, and you'll flash into a different look. So you're looking down at the battle, and you take your turn, and then the enemies take their turns, and you have to basically beat them, heal yourself, use your weapons, use your abilities to take them out. And there are a couple of innovations that Fantasian brings to the table as far as the combat goes. For example, there are different attacks that can be curved. So if you're facing 20 different enemies, and let's say one at the front has a big shield, you can kind of curve your attack to bypass that shield and hit people that are behind them, which is quite cool and not something that I've seen before. And there is also something called the Dimension, and that is a machine that will kind of bank battles. I would say one of the pitfalls of this genre is that as you're exploring the world, it can get a little tiresome to be constantly sucked into combat, which is somewhat repetitive, sort of 10 times as you're walking across one area. And so what the Dimension allows you to do is to store those enemies away. So let's say four enemies attack you, they go into the Dimension, you see that the number four has appeared at the top left-hand corner of the screen, you carry on exploring, and four more go into it, and four more. And by the time it gets to 30, that's the maximum amount of enemies that the Dimension can hold, and you are then forced to battle them. You can also choose to do it when you have like 15 or 20. But what that means is that you are allowed to explore more organically without being constantly interrupted. And then you have these kind of epic battles every 5 or 10 minutes where you just take out all of the enemies at once. And so I think that's a really smart way to sidestep that issue of feeling like your exploration is being constantly interrupted by combat. It works really well. It allows you to strategize a little bit, and it allows you to get into more of a flow with the game. It also means that after you've cleared out the Dimension of 30 different enemies, you'll get all of your experience points and items at once, rather than little trickles here and there. And so your level will often flash up after one of those giant battles and really make you feel like you're making progress in the game. You get XP, experience points, and that every time you go up a level, you'll occasionally learn a new spell or a new attack or ability. Your health will go up, your magic meter will go up, your character, your attacks will get more powerful. And so it's a traditional leveling up system, but it's just streamlined. The game also does have a skill tree system like most traditional RPGs, but it only opened up, I would say, in the last hour of this episode of the game. And so I guess it's not really relevant for this review. It looks like there's like a good 50 or so skills that you can learn, some of them generic and some of them actually adding useful new abilities. But I think that's going to be something that will be more fully explored in the second half of the game later this year. So after you've battled your way out of the factory, Leo warps out and he arrives in the human realm, and this is where most of the game takes place. It's kind of a fantasy setting with sci-fi elements, so it's almost medieval, but there are elements of technology in it too. There are robots, the technology does exist, but it is kind of medieval, it's not futuristic, so it feels like that kind of classic crossover that we see in JRPGs quite often. And as you explore this world, you try and rediscover Leo's memories, you try and jog his memory by going back to old places, by meeting people that know him and being guided to his house or to different places that he has lived, his workshop. And you meet friends from your old life who will try and jog your memory and be very surprised by Leo's amnesia. You'll meet new people along the way and you'll form different companion bands at different times. You'll have new characters to level up with different attacks and different skills to keep it fresh throughout. And the game is your journey as Leo to figure out your own past, to figure out why you have amnesia, to figure out what you were doing in this machine realm and how it's relevant to the world you're living in. You'll figure out what the mecteria infection that is taking over the human realm is. You'll interact with royal family, you'll meet mysterious strangers and all that kind of thing. The story isn't really the main appeal of this game. It's pretty tired and familiar, to be honest, but it feels like that's kind of part of the genre in some ways. I don't feel like the writing in these games has ever really been the best, but it's a stylish and appealing kind of fantasy world that you move through, and it has that feeling of like a grand adventure, even if the dialogue and the characters are a little basic and the story is a little basic. It's a certain type of fairy tale that is kind of simple, easy to understand, and fun to play through. But if the story is not the star of the show, I have to say that the visuals and the game environment and the game world definitely is. This is an interesting game in that all of the environments were made as models. The director is miniature enthusiast, and so they literally made all of these places physically as small dioramas. They then used drones equipped with 3D scanning technology to scan those environments and digitize them. And Sakaguchi has said that games with a development diorama pipeline should not exist. So I guess they got into the details of that. Sounds like they were making Lord of the Rings or something. But he also said that it offered a unique handmade touch that cannot be replicated. And the result is quite interesting because I haven't explained it yet, but as you're walking around the towns and cities and the forests and so forth of this game, it has forced perspective. So let's say you're walking down a pathway and Leo is walking away from you and turns a corner. The whole world will kind of swing around and suddenly Leo is walking to the right instead of into the distance. If you've played A Short Hike, you will know what I'm talking about. So the game world moves around you as you're walking through it. And it's really interesting what they've done because the graphical quality that is offered is quite physical. And I wasn't aware of this graphics technique as I was playing the game, but I definitely got a sense that it was quite a physical environment. I did notice that the architecture, for example, in the towns and cities of the games felt quite weighty and quite designed. And there were lots of kind of curved edges and organic shapes in the game. And I guess that's why it looks that way, because it's been literally taken from real-life models. And so it's a beautiful game to look at. And that's one thing that I think will really appeal to those original JRPG fans, is that it's classic gameplay, almost exactly the same as those old Final Fantasy games, or at least back to 7. But it's been very much updated visually, so it feels fresh and it feels contemporary. But it does have that completely classic gameplay. And the environments are wonderful. You start off in a small desert town called N, and you wander around there. It's very dusty, it's a village. There is a new town where everyone lives, and then an old town which is infected by the mecteria. And you'll see kind of abandoned buildings. You'll go into interiors where you can talk to the people that live there and get those kind of small snatches of dialogue that don't really mean anything in the larger scheme of things, but are little slices of life from the villagers. And they also just give you this kind of random history lesson. It's a little bit funny. It was the same in Final Fantasy, I remember. If you're walking around a town and talking to people, they'll speak in informative non sequiturs. Like the guard at the gate will say, "The king has just returned. He lives in the castle up the hill." And then the person just inside the gate will say, "There is an excellent weapons shop here in the west part of town." And so it's never really naturalistic or convincing. You're just talking to people who are filling you in on the facts as you walk through the game. And that kind of clunkiness is something that is kind of intrinsic to this genre. It's not like it's a scripted film, you know, like in modern games, in character-led, narrative-led modern games. The kind of the distinction between cinema and screenplay writing has kind of evolved, and literature and video games, they've all come closer together. And so we get this quite kind of literary, cinematic script style in a lot of modern games. And these old JRPGs didn't bother with that at all. It's a completely different beast. It's a completely different style of writing. It contains a lot of in-jokes. It's often quite funny and quirky. And they aren't believable characters. It is a true fantasy in that way. Like, the motivations of the characters seem incredibly simple. It's not like that each character is a fully fleshed human being with their own kind of psychology that leads to their decision-making and the things they say and do. It's more like they're kind of fun-looking chess pieces that shuffle around a beautiful board throughout the game. And that's a style of writing that I've encountered a few times in JRPGs, and that I guess fans of the genre will be familiar with and will find appealing. And there are other environments that really stand out. I think when I think back on this game, I will remember mostly places. There is that desert town of En. There is the Uzra luxury cruise ship, which is a huge, spectacular, sculptural ship that floats over the desert. And it's a luxury cruise liner. And you go on a journey on that ship, and it's a big section of the game where you're talking to the crew. It's where you'll meet the princess of the nation of Vibra, where the game is set. And there is a lot that goes on that cruise trip. It lands in the canal city of Vents, which is a fully-fledged city where you can walk around, talk to people, go into the mecteria-infested section of the city, talk to the mayor, solve problems, do quests, all that kind of thing. And then there is the capital city with the royal palace and the old town. There are various kind of dusty trails and ancient walkways. There's a coliseum and an ancient forest. All very colourful, all beautiful. It uses perspective as well and like lens blur. So often the foreground will be crisp and the background will be out of focus, and Leo will kind of walk from this crisp foreground into the background in a way that feels quite cinematic and is definitely a result of the graphics techniques that they have used. And so the game has a really cool sort of sense of place, even if the world does feel a little cold and definitely very much like a computer game world. It has a really decent sense of place throughout. It's very visual. The music, as you can hear, has got this kind of slightly easy listening sort of fantasy vibe to it, but it fits with the game really well. It's a really pleasing presentation overall. But as well as bringing along with it the classic Final Fantasy feel, it also brought along some of the pitfalls of the genre. I did actually get a flashback whilst playing it to a control problem. So this kind of forced perspective that I've been talking about, where the world moves around you, if you walk into the screen, let's say, if you're walking eastwards and you come through a gate, but then there's a kind of a moment where you move into the next environment and suddenly you're facing west, for example, there's quite a lot of times where you'll leave one area facing one way, and then when you enter the next area, you're facing a different way completely, And if you're still holding the controller joystick in the direction that you were facing, you'll immediately walk out of the area again. And I've lost count of the amount of times that I walked into an area and then immediately walked out again simply by holding the joystick in the same direction. And that gave me a little bit of a flashback to Final Fantasy VII, to having these moments of frustration where I would roll my eyes a little bit because it seems like a kind of a slight design glitch with the controls. There are a couple of other modern conveniences that are missing. I think especially for a game designed to be played on mobile, autosave is essential, and frequent restart points, because if for example, you're playing and someone says hello to you, you put down your phone for a couple minutes and then you pick it back up, the app will have often gone into the background, and I found out the hard way that it doesn't save your progress even if you just put it down for a second. Sometimes the software will restart completely if you exit the app to, for example, check a text message or a Facebook message or something. And so I often had to replay sections for 15 to 20 minutes. So really big, considerable chunks of game. And if you've just gone through, for example, like a very dialogue-heavy story section in one of Leo's many flashbacks, and then I've kind of held my phone to one side and just like clicked with my thumb, not even looking at the screen, just trying to get back to where I was. The restart points aren't great, and all of the saving is manual. And this could have been really easily fixed, you know. They could have just every time you enter a new area or change from screen to screen, they could have had an automatic restart point at the start of every screen and just solved that problem. And I think for a game that is based on mobile, autosave and restart points are really important. So they kind of, they fumbled the ball on that a little bit. So it does feel creaky. It does feel like a game from the past in some ways. But I've got a feeling that the intended audience for this game won't be mad at those things, because it's all part of the package of the kind of the classic feel that this game has. It is an old-style game with a new-style look, and I think that a certain section of gamers are going to adore that about it. My final criticism of it is that a couple of the bosses in the late game are basically kind of, if you play through at the speed that I did, by the time you get to them, I think by the time I got to Vam the Malevolent, the nasty god of this game, by the time I went into combat with Vam finally, I was at level 27, and I bounced off of Vam for three times, and I think they're quite long battles. Some of the battles are 5 or 10 minutes long, some of these boss battles. And I was kind of playing it perfectly, using a mixture of abilities, using slowing him down, putting the defense up on my party, using attack buffs to make sure that I was fully powered up, finding his elemental weaknesses, and still getting my ass kicked. And I ended up resorting to looking at an online guide, and it said you shouldn't really take him on before you're at level 30 or 31. So I just walked around in circles for a while and emptied my Dimension device a few times, leveled up to 31, and then beat him on the first try pretty easily. The same went for the last boss of the game. I wasn't quite at the right level. I just had to walk off and walk in circles and fight some baddies. So there was some kind of clumsy level gating in this game as well. So if you do play Phantasian and you find yourself up against a boss that is defeating you, just level up and you'll take care of them in no time at all. Your attacks will be stronger. You'll have more health. And so if you're doing everything right with your defensive spells and your attack buffs and so forth, it's probably just a levels thing. Which feels a little off to me. I mean, I don't like level gating generally. I think that by the time you reach an enemy in a game, you should, through the course of natural gameplay, have reached a level at which success is possible. It seems like a way to artificially elongate playtime. And it takes player skill out of the equation. If there's no chance of winning in a battle, then you really shouldn't be in that battle, in my opinion, yet, you know, in a game. But as a whole, I had a good time with Phantasian, despite those little gripes that I've given. I guess I've already talked about my opinions on the writing. Like, it's a very stiff narrative and a very familiar story, and some quirky, eccentric gameplay. But it's a visually beautiful presentation. It was a really nice flashback to the classic JRPGs. And I mean, I remember Final Fantasy VII being a real breakthrough game in some ways. I think it was the first time I had ever seen an advert for a video game on TV. I remember that was a really big deal at the time because, I mean, as a teenager at the time, games weren't really on TV. They weren't really part of popular culture in that way. Games had not yet advanced to the kind of the mass cultural events that they are today. And so Final Fantasy VII really did feel like a landmark title, where games really pierced the conversation and became like a kind of a mass cultural phenomenon. And especially Japanese games, or like overtly JRPG style games, it was like a kind of important blockbuster that kind of changed the game. And a really epic game, you know, that was a long game. And I think for everyone that played it back at that time, it was just kind of unforgettable. It's huge and ambitious. And so Fantasian is a nice tribute to it. Smaller in scope, but visually more ambitious. And I do hope that it comes to other consoles, because I think the JRPG fan base aren't necessarily on Apple Arcade, which is mostly about shorter, snappier games. I have noticed on Twitter that there are some JRPG fans who've been a little disappointed that Mistwalker have put this game onto Apple Arcade, but I'm sure it will make its way to the consoles eventually. That's Fantasian. So that's our episode. I hope you enjoyed hearing about Fantasian. I enjoyed playing it. Thanks very much for listening. If you would like to come and let me know your thoughts about JRPGs, about Final Fantasy VII, about Fantasian, you can find me on Twitter at Gaming in the Wild. I'm also on Instagram, YouTube, and Twitch. But I'm mostly on Twitter talking about games every day. I love to hear from people who have listened to the show, so feel free to get in touch there. There is also the Patreon. If you've enjoyed this episode and gotten this far, from as little as $1 a month, you can support the show. That's at patreon.com/gamingintheWild. Thank you very much to all my existing patrons, and thank you to you if you're thinking of becoming one of them. I'll be back next week with a new episode. Thanks very much for listening. Take care of yourselves and each other. Bye-bye for now.